So as we just heard, when Fernanda first came to the United States, she thought that sports would be a good way to fit in, which is not exactly a new way of thinking. Immigrants and other outsiders have used sports as a way to belong since, well, forever. Back in 1939, for example, one Mexican-American high school team shot for the stars using basketball as their launching pad. Latino USA producer Noam Hassenfeld has our story.
1939. The two best high school basketball teams in San Antonio are squaring off in the championship. On one side, the home court Eagles from Brackenridge, an all-white team with fans packing the stands. On the other side, the Vokes from Lanier High School, an all-Mexican-American team from San Antonio's west side. It's a striking image. Tall, lanky white kids playing against a team of mostly short, skinny Mexican-American players led by their star, Tony Cardona, all 5'1" of him. It's a tie game in sudden death overtime. The next basket wins the championship. The Brackenridge Eagles have the ball, and as they get close to the Lanier hoop...
Brackenridge got the ball. They went down, and they missed the shot.
This is Professor Ignacio Garcia, a former Lanier student and the author of When Mexicans Could Play Ball, a book about Lanier's team.
Joe Trevino, who was the big center, just went up, gobbled the ball, passed it out to Billy Saldana. He sees Tony Cardona, who was the star player, running toward the Brackenridge basket. He throws the ball, and a beautiful pass.
What happened next shocked a lot of people. But to understand exactly what was at stake, we need to zoom out a bit. You see, Lanier wasn't just a Mexican-American high school. It was also one of the first vocational schools in an urban center in the country. That's actually where they got their name, Vokes, short for vocational. And being a vocational school meant that students were taught one of seven trades, including auto painting and sheet metal welding. The idea was...
these kids can't go to college, but they're really good with their hands.
Teaching students trades was a way to get them a job, not a way to prepare them for better-paying white-collar work or leadership roles. But bringing Mexican-American students from Lanier into the workforce also had a deeper motivation.
If you could assimilate them into the workforce, then you were assimilating them into American society.
And this wasn't exactly subtle. At Lanier, the messaging was explicit.
Every Monday, the school would issue you a ribbon that said, I speak English, I'm an American.
Joe Bernal, a former Lanier student who played for the Vokes in 1944.
If they heard you speaking Spanish, they would go, I say, come here. And they'd take your pen away from you, get your name and your homeroom teacher, and you got demerits.
And Joe says it wasn't just the school.
My parents were very supportive of the school forcing us in some way to speak English.
In some ways, this was a reflection of the time period. Here's Professor Garcia again.
Unlike today, where you have, 55 million Latinos, there was a perception in the 30s that you had to integrate and assimilate because there really was no Mexican-American future in the way we perceive it today.
And one of the best ways to speed up that integration? Basketball. And this resonated with many Mexican-American leaders in the 1930s.
They felt like if we can do well in their game, then undoubtedly that dissipates part of that idea that we're foreigners. There was this notion that sports can make us good Americans.
But Lanier still needed to find the perfect coach, someone who checked off multiple boxes, athlete, teacher, Mexican-American, but more importantly, someone who understood how tenuous the line was that he would need to walk every day. Someone like William Herrera, or as most people called him, Nemo. Nemo was born in 1900 to a Mexican-American mother and a Mexican father in Brownsville, Texas, a city in the Rio Grande Valley just north of Mexico. His family moved north to San Antonio shortly after he was born, and he went to Brackenridge High School. He was the first Mexican-American student to play sports at Brackenridge, and he was actually the first ever to graduate. And he saw up close what could happen if he didn't fit in.
By the time he's in his 20s, part of, Operation Repatriation and other massive deportations had occurred. A lot of the Mexican-American families said, look, we've got to integrate. We've got to assimilate. We've got to not be seen as different because tomorrow it could be us.
That's Professor Garcia again. And just a note, we're not going to be hearing from Nemo himself in this story. He passed away in 1984. So Nemo bought into what Lanier, and to be fair, what much of the Mexican-American community at the time was preaching. Fully embrace American culture, speak English, don't stand out. and he channeled that message into basketball. Though he had a Spanish last name, he chose to pronounce it with an Anglo accent, Herrera. And even though both he and his players spoke Spanish fluently, he made sure to follow the example set by Lanier.
I never heard Nemo speak Spanish like we did. He wasn't letting up on the idea that we should all speak English in school.
He knew coaching a Mexican-American basketball team wouldn't be easy. Basketball might just be the quintessential American game. After all, unlike baseball and football, which evolved from English sports, basketball is the only major American sport invented from scratch in the U.S. And white Texans didn't take kindly to a team of Mexican-Americans playing basketball, and playing it well.
They weren't supposed to be able to do that. You know, there was this perception that the Mexicans could not play at that level.
People regularly said things like,
their kids know their X and O's as good as they know their frijoles and tortillas. They play defense like mosquitoes.
They called the Vokes
wetbacks, dirty Mexicans, greasers. That was common.
Even though they kept winning games, the Vokes were never seen as equals by their white competition. Here's David Rodriguez, a former Lanier student who played on the Vokes from 1943 to 45.
I don't think they ever felt like we were Americans yet.
But no matter what the players thought, Nemo's response was always the same.
At the beginning of the year, he always set us down and told us, you know, we're going to play, we're going to win, and you're not going to listen to the crowd, and don't listen to the taunts, the remarks they make.
You know, anybody saying anything ugly to you, the way you show them is to outplay them.
Let's go back to where we started. The 1939 San Antonio championship game between the all-Mexican-American Lanier Vokes and the all-white Brackenridge Eagles.
The newspaper people really played it up. This is the perfect matchup. Two teams that have played each other twice, and they both scored the same amount of points with each other. They've gone to the other person's home and they've won. What more sort of dream game can you have than this?
It's a hard-fought physical game. And even though the Eagles have a height advantage, the Vokes respond with Nemo's brilliant game plan of quick passes. But the Vokes also have a secret weapon, Nemo's protege, Tony Cardona.
He was so tiny, about 5'1", 5'2", and he was so fast, and he was undoubtedly the best player in the city.
Led by Tony, the Vokes keep the game close, trailing by only 2 points in the final minute. The Vokes get the ball with a chance to tie the game, and somehow the ball ends up in the hands of little-used backup Alonzo Rodriguez, whose miraculous shot ties it up. It's almost poetic. The two teams who each beat each other once earlier in the year, who scored the same exact number of points in two-plus games to this point, have played each other to a standstill. The clock hits zero with the score tied. The game will go to overtime.
Of course, overtime back in those days was whoever gets the ball and scores first wins the game. So you could win it with one shot within seconds.
The Brackenridge Eagles get the ball to start overtime and work their way to the hoop. They get close, but the shot misses and the Vokes grab the rebound. Out of the corner of his eye, Billy Saldana sees Tony Cardona streaking down the sideline straight to the Eagles' basket. Billy heaves a beautiful pass across the court. Tony catches the ball in stride and puts the ball up. And it goes straight through the hoop. The Lanier Vokes are San Antonio High School champions. An all-Mexican-American starting five defeating an all-Anglo team in basketball. In 1939, this was huge. It might not seem like a big deal, but this was almost 10 years before Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball. At the time, even more than baseball, basketball was a white man's game. But before this could all sink in for Tony and for the rest of the Vokes,
someone from the stands came down and he hit Tony Cardona in the back of the head.
There were not too many Lanier fans there, and they were outnumbered, and the Brackenridge people more or less ganged up on them. You know, they were surrounded by Brackenridge fans. It was kind of scary.
And things got out of hand pretty quickly.
The players started pushing each other. The coaches came in quickly, but the fans had already joined. The fans just got into it on the court, in the stands, and they took it outside. They grabbed rocks, started throwing at each other, at cars and the building itself. One young man got stabbed. Others got beaten.
As for Tony, who had become a hero only moments earlier,
the assistant coach grabbed him, dragged him out, and put him in his car and said, just lay down on the floor. And all he could hear was, let's get Tony, let's get Tony.
Tony stayed hidden, and eventually the police showed up.
It took 8 police cars and a number of policemen to not only break up the fight, but to allow the bus that was carrying both the Lanier team and Lanier fans to be able to get out of Breckenridge, and they got pelted with rocks.
Imagine how difficult seeing this riot must have been for Coach Nima.
He must have looked out there and seen a fight, and it wasn't just, you know, one school against the other. It really broke down on racial lines, and I think that was extremely uncomfortable for Nemo because he was sort of outside of that conflict. He didn't bring it to the locker room. He didn't bring it to practice. He didn't bring it home. But now it had intruded in the most important moment at that time of his life.
Remember, this is a man who really believed that if he and his players wanted it bad enough, they could fit in, that they could be judged on a level playing field. And his players bought into what Nemo was preaching. Even after being punched in the back of the head, even after being forced to hide on the floor of his car, his star player Tony didn't think the attack was racially motivated.
His take on it was their team lost and I made the last shot, so they came and they whacked me. That was his take on it.
Now, Tony has also since passed away, but when Professor Garcia spoke with him, Tony's wife thought it was important to let both of them know what she experienced that day.
She interrupted and said, "Tony, I sat on the stands, and I know what they said about you, and I know what the horrible things that were being said."
Tony had bought into Nemo's message of assimilation so much that he didn't want to see racism, even when it literally hit him right in the head. As for Nemo...
Nemo was not naive. Nemo knew.
Nemo knew that racism was behind the riot, even though it went against everything he so desperately wanted to be true.
So he chose not to speak to it.
For Nemo's whole life, he believed that if he just kept his head down and did things the right way, he'd be accepted by white Anglo-Texas. And he found out that wasn't true in the most dramatic way possible. But what's interesting is what happened next. He kept going. He didn't change. He didn't quit. He just went right back to the same message, telling his players to focus on the game, to not stand out. And Lanier kept right on winning. They went on to win not only a city championship, not only a state championship, but two state championships in the next few years. They became the best high school basketball team in the entire state of Texas. And still, Texas never quite accepted them. Here's former player David Rodriguez again.
We felt like we didn't get the notoriety we deserved, the wins we had. When we won the state in 1943, there was no parties, no nothing.
And the Vokes still had some scary moments along the way. Once, at a regional tournament, they arrived at a gym, only to be greeted by a man with a shotgun. Here's Joe Bernal again.
He used some choice words. You Mexicans don't belong here. Get back to where you came from. And he was pointing the shotgun, double barrel. I could see those two dark circles right in my face. My thought was, if that gun explodes, I'm gone.
Coach Nemo quickly stepped in, explaining that they were there to play basketball.
And the gentleman said something to the effect that Mexicans don't play basketball.
Joe Bernal is nearing his 90th birthday this year. Remember, Joe is the former Lanier player who spoke about the ribbons, which read, "I'm an American, I speak English." And Joe was actually a student council representative at Lanier. He was the one taking ribbons away from the students if he heard them speaking Spanish.
As I grew older, you know, and found out that what I was doing back there, which I thought was good, and I had parental support for it, the way you did it was a put down just because you happened to be speaking the language, your mother tongue.
I asked Joe what he would have done if he'd been in charge.
I wouldn't do it because you grow up being ashamed of who you are.
And that's the thing about trying to fit in. It means you have to give something up. And even if you do make that sacrifice, molding yourself to fit into a society that holds you at arm's length, who's to say they'll accept you? They let you go to school, but they tell you what to study. They let you play basketball, but they don't like it when you win. In 1930s Texas, Nemo and Tony must have understood that they would never truly fit in. But they pushed. And America pushed back.
Thanks to Noam Hassenfeld for that story.